Today we have the pleasure of sitting down with Michelle Thierry. She is a 26-year veteran of the Phoenix Police Department. She has lots of thoughts and ideas about size up and leadership and taking care of yourself both mentally and physically. So let's take a listen to what she has to say. Welcome to the Fireground Fitness Podcast. I'm your host, Rain Gray. Here, we're going to talk about all things pertaining to life on and off the fireground. The opinions expressed are mine and those of the guest. So, let's get started. So, Michelle, tell me a little bit about where you grew up, and I'm going to pretend like I don't know.
All right. I born and raised in Phoenix, Arizona. Grew up in the central part of Phoenix now. Wasn't at the time, was pretty much north end of Phoenix. But in that Metro Center area, went to Cortez High School.
How was that?
Good years. Fun. Yeah. Nice. You know, I think we discussed a little bit, but I enjoyed sports my whole life, right? Yeah. Played some softball, played some tennis, did a little running with my dad. Maybe even some of those field days we used to have in high school. Mm-hmm. My PE coach would always say, Michelle needs to be on a track team. Why isn't she on a track team? Well, it's because I love softball at the time.
Too many other good things to do.
Yeah, yeah. But later on in high school, I did end up getting on that cross country team out of discipline from my tennis coach who didn't like my outbursts. Mm. And she sent me for laps.
So as a tennis player, you had some attitude.
I had some it was all self-directed, you know, for the most part, except when I was playing my best friend and I'd call her a poisonous snake for, you know, serving an ace. But for the most part, my outbursts were to myself when I hit one out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, or well, hit the net.
Okay, we'll let you tell that story.
Yeah. So my outburst, she didn't like it, you know. I had no tennis manners. I called myself a banshee player because I taught myself no lessons, no, along with lessons you learn about etiquette.
Yeah.
No etiquette, yeah. Right? Yeah. Just a banshee on the court. And so, but it did fairly well because I was pretty quick. Could get to anything, would dive for it, would jump back up and play the game like a banshee.
You're a committed athlete.
Yeah. So, but my outburst, she didn't like it because she was a formal player and she had etiquette and discipline. Mm-hmm. So she'd send me for a lap every time I had an outburst and maybe even cussed. Let's face it. I have a foul mouth.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm surprised.
I learned some words. And so, you know, I even learned the words in Spanish. And then she talked to the Spanish teacher and realized I was still cussing. And so it's still laps. And but doing those laps, you know, made friends of some cross country runners and the cross country coach, and they got together and they said, keep sending her to the track and she's gonna run track. And coach says no, but cross country would work out good because it's not the same season as tennis, and then we can do both.
So what did you run? What disciplines were you running in, or what events?
Simply the cross country long distance event. So, and at the time, long distance for women's cross country was anywhere from a mile and a half to 3 mile races.
Okay.
And so those were my distances.
Okay. So did you, when you came out of high school, did you go to college, or what did you do out of high school?
I did. Yeah. I went to Northern Arizona University.
Nice.
And I did not play sports there. Just went to school at that time. And,
nice. What'd you study?
And I trained a lot anyway, but I studied criminal justice.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. You were doing cross country in high school, and I happen to know that you're an endurance athlete, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But were you, coming out of high school, did you get into the kind of endurance athletics? When did you start that part of your
life? That's exactly what happened. I went to college, NAU. I wasn't done with sports. Maybe I thought I was, but I wasn't. And I got into triathlon there. I was lifeguarding during the summer, so I was already swimming. Mm-hmm. I already liked running. All I needed to do was add that riding. So I bought myself a used Peugeot 10-speed bike.
Nice.
And I started dabbling in triathlon while I was there in college. Did some triathlon training courses even. And then started up with my first few races the last year of college.
That's cool. So you must have done, did you do the Mountain Man Triathlon?
I don't know. They didn't call it that back then, but yes. I mean, I did one of the first Mountain Man Triathlons when they came up with it?
That was one of my early tries was the Mountain Man Triathlon, and it was out at Mormon Lake.
Yes, Mary.
Was it Lake Mary?
Yeah. Because Mormon's marshy.
Well, this race was pretty marshy.
It was marshy. Okay, maybe so it was Mormon Lake.
It was probably Lake Mary, but all I remember is the water level was really low.
Yes.
And every stroke of my hand was through weeds.
And maybe it was Mormon Lake.
As I swam. It was horrible.
I'm glad they came up with another one.
Yeah, it was fun. And the other thing about it was I came up from the valley straight up to Flagstaff the morning of the race, and I never really thought about, you know, breathing and hypoxia at altitude.
Yeah.
And, oh my heavens, what a suck fest. It was miserable. And, you know, anyways, it was a relatively short course race. And so, the suffering wasn't too long.
Right.
But man, it took a lot out of me swimming and not being able to breathe.
I'll bet.
It was a challenge.
See, now that doesn't happen to me. And I think it's because I lived in Flagstaff during those 4 years and I got acclimated to the high altitude.
Oh, yeah. So you still go back to altitude and don't have a problem?
I don't.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And maybe it's because as a kid, my dad had us hiking and hunting up in the mountains a lot, too. So maybe I got used to it.
Yeah.
But I don't seem to be affected by it.
Yeah.
But I know my friends are.
Yeah,
I've seen
doubt.
It. Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
So when did you guys do a bunch of hiking up on Mount Humphreys?
Yes, we did.
I mean, I can't imagine living up there. You get to play all the time. There's all kinds of recreation.
Very distracting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine. So skiing, hiking. Did you get into mountain biking while you're up there?
I did.
Yeah, how could you not?
Yeah.
Right? It's all the trails.
And it was fairly new at the time.
Yeah. That was the early days of the sport, right?
Yeah.
The late 90s or early 90s, sorry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's awesome. So when did you, we're going to keep going down this road here, because I know you've raced Ironman. So you started off in college doing, the sprint triathlons, I imagine, and, the local stuff. And then you evolved. When did you start doing Ironman?
When Ironman came to Arizona.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So not until like 2005?
Yeah. So, Ironman's always that ultimate goal of any triathlete. They're always watching that going, I wonder if I could.
Yeah.
And all the while, I'm thinking, okay, I'm working full time. I got a child full time, a husband and two kids part time, my stepchildren. And I'm thinking, man, I don't think I can do that until I'm retired.
Right.
And in my business, you can retire fairly young, early 50s, late 40s, if you want. And so I'm thinking, I'll do that when I retire. Well, then it comes right to our hometown.
Right.
Arizona. So I'm like, I got to jump in. I think I can do it.
Right.
I just got to be disciplined. So
what kind of distances had you achieved at that point in your career?
Olympic.
Oh, that's a big step.
Yeah.
Olympic trial.
Yeah. I hadn't even done the half iron yet. And I never did do the half iron before the Ironman distance. And then after that, I was like, now half Ironman is going to seem simple.
No doubt.
And it does.
Yeah. Once you've accomplished an Ironman. So I think you and I met doing the West Valley road rides, training for that first Ironman.
Indeed. Yes, we did. And then we continued training together because sometimes, the West Valley ride isn't exactly the same as what that Ironman needs.
Right.
They need a little extra.
Right.
They need a little bit slower pace.
By
slow, I don't mean slow, but you just don't need to go 100% if you got to go extra 50 miles.
The road ride where you're doing sprint intervals is different than setting a pace that's going to sustain for 112 miles.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a big difference.
Yeah, so we spent some long days on the bike together.
Yeah.
That's how I learned about rain.
So let's not talk about that. We're not talking about that.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about my saddle sores and my slow pacing.
No, you were doing good.
So tell me, so go back a little bit. So when you graduated college, how quickly did you get into, at what point did you know you want to be a police officer?
I knew pretty young in life, honestly.
So before college, you were already headed out. But you said you studied criminal justice. So you had your head there.
I already had my head in that game.
So what drew you there?
I think probably part adventurous lifestyle, I would say. I mean, I was in my brain as a kid, I was going to be an astronaut or a police officer. And who knows, maybe it's because you watch these television shows, the Bionic Man was an astronaut, right?
Right.
And then you learn a little about a job as you grow up and you think, oh my God, it would be cool to go off on a rocket ship. It would be cool to, you know, be able to be on the ground helping people and catching bad guys, for lack of better terms. But, right. you know, basically doing that thing that actually gives back, you know. And I think as kids, maybe you think about what you could do in life that would be important. And both of those seem like important things, but one of them seemed like my brain wasn't quite ready for rocket science. And so I...
it's important to recognize some limitations.
Yes, yes, yeah. And then, so I went with, I would like to do police work. And then the more you research a career, the more you realize, oh yeah, that's for me. And so I kind of knew before I went to college that that was the route I was going to pursue.
So I hear you saying that there's kind of the public service aspect of it. You want to help people. And then was there any, what other aspects of it kind of attracted you? Was it the physical, kind of the physical fitness element of it, or the physicality of the job? Was that an attraction to you?
Absolutely. You know, it was a noble profession. It involves a lot of physical work. It involves teamwork, you know, it involves adrenaline. Mm-hmm. So all those things appealed to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And especially the teamwork aspect. You can't beat that.
Right. Yeah, that's, well, in growing up playing sports, you're surrounded by that element. And so it's interesting that you go into certain workspaces. Did you do any other jobs that kind of gave you some perspective on that?
Just lifeguarding and coaching swim teams and teaching swim lessons.
So I
pretty much went right into this.
So you didn't need anything else to offer you perspective.
No.
You know, it's, I've always found that I've had several different jobs as I was kind of coming up and going through college, et cetera. And I'm like, those really helped me anchor in to what I knew was important in my work, right? I knew if I was working retail, like, okay, this isn't, this is helping people, but this isn't really helping people. These people, like, anybody can do this.
Right.
Right. And so for me, as I found the chemistry in the fire service, I'm like, okay, that chemistry meets these other markers of job satisfaction, right?
Right.
You know, the team element of it, the caring and compassion, the opportunity to serve in the community, like that, those elements all stood out to me. And I'm like, oh, they're all present there in a much more real way than anywhere else I could look, right?
Right.
For me, that was the attraction.
Very similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I imagine so. And so you graduate college and you head right into, how soon are you off onto the PD journey?
Immediately, like too soon. So if I could go back and do it a little different, hey, maybe I would have taken that whole summer if it were my choice, and it wasn't. I guess it is, but it isn't.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when a job is offered to you that you have gone to college for 4 years and spent some money,
You feel obligated.
And I had skin in the game. My dad didn't pay for my whole college. I paid for half. So my skin is in that game. And now I've gone to school for 4 years and they're offering me a job the very next week after I graduate. Go into the academy. You don't say no. And that's part of my upbringing too. If something's handed to you and it's what you wanted, it doesn't matter if it's not the timing you want. You take it.
Right.
And so absolutely, they said, you're hired. Can you start tomorrow? No, I'm still trying to get my degree and I'm literally half a semester away. And it's in Flagstaff and you're in Phoenix. And they say, okay, when do you graduate? I said, you know, the date.
So had you already entered, and pardon me for going back on this, but had you already gone through the testing process? Or was the process different?
No, I went through it. So I started that testing process knowing the pattern for friends of mine who had already gone through. Mm-hmm. The pattern was about 6 months it takes to get from test to hiring. So I take that pattern, right? And I say, okay, about 6 months out, I need to start taking the test.
Yeah.
So I take that written test. I pass the written test. The next is they give us a date on spring break, my spring break. Luckily, right? Because I could just come down and I took that physical fitness test. And as soon as I passed that, the recruiter said, okay, how soon can you take the polygraph, a medical exam, a psychological exam, and an oral board interview?
Right.
How fast can you do that? And I'm like, I'm still in school. I'm home for spring break right now. And they scheduled all of those right then.
During spring break.
Yeah. And you know, I think we talked about this a little bit earlier. It's kind of hard to find a person, an applicant who can pass that written psychological background check, drug tests, physical fitness. That physical fitness, it stopped some people. You gotta be able to do a certain amount of push-ups, sit-ups in a minute. You gotta run certain amount of a mile and a half in a certain amount of time, jump a 6-foot wall. Not a lot of women can jump that 6-foot wall because of the upper body strength
right.
that's involved and the size. I mean, if you're right. tall, it's not as big of a jump up.
Right.
But I could, because I've been doing that stuff since I was a kid.
Right.
I had to jump a 6-foot wall to get back in my house after I snuck out. I'm used to that, right? So not that I was a bad kid, but sometimes Dad said no and I wanted to. So
you talk about that in the polygraph.
I had to tell him everything. Yeah, the polygraph, yes.
So would you submit that, and this, I'm going to put this on you. I don't know if it's right or not.
All right.
How different are the candidates today than they were back then when you first were going through?
Interesting question, because it depends on who you ask, right? I know that we talk about generations and how the millennial generation is different from the one we grew up in. But I think every generation sometimes thinks that theirs was the better generation and this new one, mm-hmm. they're pansies, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that. I think you just got to find the right ones. Because as I became a supervisor eventually, and as I became a supervisor, I was amazed at the high quality of our officers that we had chosen and that I was supervising. I was absolutely amazed. And part of what amazes me is the job itself has become more difficult, and yet their attitudes are still good.
Right.
If you threw one of, let's say, the older generation into the brand new rookie stage now, they wouldn't know what to do because they're like, holy shit, I didn't have to do all this paperwork. You know, the new generation, they're raised on it and they're used to it. So they're really good with computers. I mean,
right.
the investigations that we have to do now and the amount of paperwork that we have to do now, it's nice to have someone who knows how to work around a computer and internet crimes and finding suspects on the internet. I mean, they're just good at it. So
right.
in some ways, they're better than us as a whole generation. And maybe in some ways we were good too. We were, absolutely. Right. And so was the one before us. You know
right.
what I mean?
So it's interesting you say that. So where my mind goes is the fact that the generation that is currently, the incoming generation, is probably best suited for the current context of the operation.
Heck yeah.
Right? Because
yeah.
they have that skill set that is contemporary and current. So as organizational leaders, and I'm hoping we can go dive down this hole maybe a little bit later here, but
yeah.
but it's incumbent upon us to help lead those folks down the right path, right? So they have the right skill set, and it's our job to expose those talents and to utilize those talents, whatever they may be, instead of judging them off of our own personal value set, right? That might be skewed to our personal history in the,
yes.
in the organization, right? So we have to look at the future and say, what skill set do they have that I don't have, and not let our ego get in the way of exploiting that,
yep.
but help them, you know, help lift them up so they can succeed with
right.
their skill set.
Right. Toughness gets built from the demand that's placed on it. If they're not tough now, they will be, just
right.
like us.
Right.
You know, you don't come into your line of work or my line of work and it's all roses. It's mm-hmm. shell shock for a little bit.
Right.
No matter who you were, no matter what generation, when you come into it, it's shell shock. And you learn to rise to the occasions that are demanded of you.
Right.
So all we got to do is teach them how to do that and then value whatever they bring to the table, which is a whole lot, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So I want to talk about that. But before we do that, I don't want to lose this opportunity and go back. Like, I'm looking at this picture of you
yeah.
right at the beginning of your career.
Yeah.
And you were young.
Yeah.
I mean, really think about it. You're fresh out of college. So how old are you? What, 23?
22.
22?
Yeah.
Holy mackerel. So you're 22 years old and what's your first assignment in the Phoenix Fire Department. Or sorry, in the Phoenix Police Department.
Police Department. First, every one of us goes straight to patrol. We do our term in patrol.
Yeah.
Usually 3 years.
And where was that?
That was in South Phoenix. It was called Sky Harbor Precinct, but it's in the Southern Zone. So yeah. We have zones. So do you, I know. Southern Zone was Sky Harbor, Maryvale, and South Phoenix Precinct. And so I was in that Southern Zone right there by the airport and just a little south and north of it.
Okay. So like the River Bottom and the...
Yeah.
And the... yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a... when I think of South Phoenix, it's a pretty tough area.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. So how was that as a rookie cop with a baby face?
Shell shock. Yeah. Yeah. And baby face was the thing. You know, a lot of people would say to me, you're just a kid. You know, I want to talk to a grown up.
And, right.
Well, that's me. I am a grown up and I'm here. And
did you just like bow up a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah.
Stand a little bit taller.
Yeah. Yeah. And in my brain, I'm going, man, I can't wait till I get some age on me. Maybe a few wrinkles and some gray hair. Stupid thinking as a 22-year-old.
Sure,
but... I'd take that all back right now. I would always hope that one day somebody would look at me and stop saying, you're just a kid, right?
Right.
And it happens, probably the way you carry yourself eventually.
So did some of that ever affect your attitude toward people? Like force you to carry yourself a little differently to try to belay some of that conversation a little bit? So what did you do differently?
So the business itself toughens you up. The way people talk to you, the way people treat you. Police officers don't get called to a scene because somebody wants help. We get called to a scene because somebody is having the worst day of their life, usually. And they haven't recognized necessarily they need help, but they need someone to control the situation. And as a young officer, 22 years old, baby face, they weren't looking for you. They were looking for somebody a lot bigger with a lot more authority behind them. And so then, of course, I would have to carry myself a little taller, you know, throw my shoulders back, stand up straight, look the part, talk the part. Half of it is talking the part, you know, a little more command in your voice, less asking, more telling. I mean, I might ask once, but then it becomes a tell. And after it's a tell, it usually becomes a make, right? Because I can't have you controlling me when I'm controlling this situation that you've asked me to control. You just don't recognize that you have.
Right.
I think that my attitude changed a little from you know, nice young girl to stern parent type of attitude where no more nonsense. Let's just get down to business. You're going to do this. Or else this might happen, right? So that's kind of how I had to carry myself as a younger officer. And then you find the balance. When do you need to use more authority? When do you use less? Who do you talk to with more authority? Who do you talk to more as friend-to-friend chat so that you can calm them down a little bit? So we used to call it verbal judo, but it's all about how you communicate to people on the level they're having right there with you.
Right. Yeah. So what's interesting is that I think that in difficult situations, and this could be taken across all kinds of domains, right? Where we're talking about dealing with people on the street or dealing with a spouse or whatever, communication is critical.
Yes. Right?
And so it's interesting, and I think this is part of what's really interesting about what you're saying is that as a 22-year-old, I look back to myself as a 22-year-old. I'm like, I had no clue, right? How to communicate effectively. I was I thought that everybody, as a young Marine, everybody was a private to me. And, you know, when I was a young corporal, I was just yelling and screaming and bossing people around. That felt like effective communication.
Right.
My wife would tell me that is not the case.
Not here.
Yeah. I would come home from field ops and start bossing her around. And she's like, don't talk to me like I'm some kind of, you know, Lance Corporal.
Good for her.
Yeah. I'm not your private. And
growth period for both of you.
100%, right? Yep. I started referring to her as the Commandant. but I digress. It's really interesting. And you know, people can't see you right now, but you are not a big person, right? You're a...
I like to think of myself as tall.
You carry yourself with some swagger, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying you're Well, how tall are you? About 5'9"?
I'm 5'6".
5'6". Yeah. Okay. Like I said, not a very big person.
Right.
So, and you have a slight build. You're an endurance athlete. So it's not like you're muscly 5'6" and, you know, giant muscle bound gal. So you're smaller. So did you ever feel, and as an athlete, you know, you carry yourself with confidence and because you know how to move. And did you ever feel like, that your size put you in a difficult position?
It's so funny you say that. I know my fighting weight, which is funny because, I mean, like you said, I'm not big, but I know my fighting weight. I know my tipping point to where I'm ineffective or where I can stand my ground. And so as an endurance athlete, you tend to lose that weight pretty easy.
Yeah.
And I know I can't go below 120. That's my marker. Mm. I like to stay at 120. I don't much like going above. But I also know, but if I go down to 117, which I did during Ironman,
yeah,
I can't fight. I can't hold
my... You feel weaker.
You feel weaker. You can't. You feel like somebody can push you around. You can't hold your ground. And I've been in a fight at 117 and at 120, even 122. Mm. But let's be honest, 122 is probably my better fighting weight.
Yeah.
I just don't like being there because I have no wiggle room in my brain, right? That's a whole nother topic. But in my brain, I don't have the wiggle room. I want to have ice cream.
We don't want to get too far into those dark corners.
Those are dark corners, right? Too dark. Okay, so here's my fighting weight. 120 or slightly above. I don't get thrown around. Lose that weight, even 3 pounds, I get thrown around in a fight. And I felt it. And it's not like I'm just saying this. It's absolutely, I was in a fight and thrown around at 117. But at 120 plus, I can hold my own ground and maybe stick. My sticking power is better.
Hmm.
You know what that means because you do jujitsu. You know what sticking power is.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I feel like I'm cheating because I'm 240 pounds.
Well,
so I can
not when you're wrestling someone 240.
A little heavier.
but you get it. Yeah, I know you get it. You know you're fighting weight. You go over that and you don't feel as effective. Mm-hmm. You go under that, you don't feel quite as effective. We all have that zone where we're effective.
Yeah.
And so I know my zone.
I think when you talk about sticking point and you talk about being a little bit overweight or underweight, like the ability to move and to effectively, be nimble and move in your own body changes with weight and fitness and your ability to carry that weight, whatever it is, right? And if you get too light, you where's that lightness coming from? Well, it might be from muscle atrophy or whatever. So you're actually... Not only are you a little bit lighter, but you're physically weaker.
Absolutely.
And, I found, so when I was doing a lot of endurance athletics, I was, down around 190. Mm-hmm. And I got to a point where I was like, I feel just weak.
Right.
And I'm not strong enough to do the things that I know I'm required to do.
We probably felt the same at the same periods right after Ironman, right?
Right. So the truly atrophied form, right? Yeah, I could go for days, but I didn't have enough strength to carry my gear and mm-hmm. feel like I could truly be effective on the fire ground. So for me, I started strength training and trying to put on some mass and just to be a little bit more powerful.
Right.
And with that, I grew some muscle mass and gained a little bit of stature,
right.
Which in turn made me more capable,
right?
More capable on the fire ground, as long as I maintain the cardiovascular fitness as well, the ability to have high intensity output. So those things all had to be coupled in to a real well-balanced program. But for me, right around 225 was like my true balance point where I was able to do endurance athletics and yet still be strong and powerful. And
that's your fight and weight right there.
There you go. So that's so that's what I would call my fight and weight too, where I feel the best and I feel healthy and strong.
Yep.
I'm a little bit outside of that right now. It's
we're
not going to get into that.
We have ups and downs in life.
Well, 100%. So the key is understanding what's appropriate and pursuing that. So for you, let me ask you this. So did you, in any of your physical fitness training, knowing that you needed to have a certain amount of strength for the job, but you wanted to be balanced with your own personal hobbies and endurance, how did you balance it? Did you do any strength training?
I did. Yeah. I developed my own little, I call it my own little program, right? Uh-huh. I call it the minimum daily quota. It's my little program. I developed this from my little young son who was like training for basketball. Uh-huh. And, you know, during the summer, he had to do some things to maintain it. And I'm like, okay, well, we're going to make this schedule. So I make this minimum daily quota, and it just started out with push-ups, pull-ups, box jumps, and sit-ups. And you had to do a set of each, so it was one superset.
Okay.
And then you had to do that superset four times. And so we would do that, both of us. Those are all good exercises to get the core of you, right?
Yeah.
The core power. And then I switch it up a little, and then I give him columns to choose from. But he chooses one from each column and makes a superset out of it. So he has choices now. And I'm like, I like these too. These work for me too.
What type of exercises are you doing?
We're talking the same. You can still stick with your pull-ups, push-ups, box jumps, sit-ups. But then I would, maybe in the column with pull-ups, I would say, okay, instead of pull-ups, you can do handstand push-ups. Or instead of that, you can do, what are some other things? I had him do some rows with some dumbbells.
Okay.
So I would give exercises in the column that were similar, but not exact, so that you could change. And we would do this daily, 5 days a week. Because I would tell him, this is minimum. It's like brushing your teeth 3 times a day. That's a minimum.
Yeah.
So if you want to go out and do a run or do some hurdles over your ice chest, we set up ice chests to jump over, then that's a secondary workout. Or for me, if I want to go on my bike or do a swim, that's a secondary workout or a run. But this core group of strength exercises are your minimum. Got to do it 5 days a week. I gave him the 2 days off on the weekend for playing hoops and for mom to run, bike, swim.
Right.
But anyway, and then some of the either box steps, box jumps, squat jumps, walking lunges with a weight overhead.
Right.
And then for sit-ups, maybe you do sit-ups, maybe you do planks, maybe you stand on your head and lift your legs up. But various different exercises that work that same group, but don't get you bored. And so we changed it up. I still do it to this day.
I love that.
And it works really good when you have a busy schedule, you know? You can't not do it. It's like brushing your teeth.
Well, so that's a really interesting thing. Two things that you talked about that I thought were really interesting. One is this idea that you have to have the unexceptional, right? There's no exceptions.
Right.
And so this item is something that you will do every day, you know, the minimum, what you call minimum daily mm-hmm. quota.
Yeah.
And so you make a deal with yourself that you will not exclude that.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, any good, it's a part of good hygiene, right? You're going to brush your teeth. You're going to do your minimum bit of work. And then if you do that early in the day, you know you've done it.
Absolutely.
And, which is a beautiful thing, right? So, you know, you get up, you make your bed, you brush your teeth, you do your little minimum daily quota, and off you go.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I think is really cool is that you shared that with your son. I mean, I think that's tremendous. You know, we talk about leadership and things like that, but if you don't provide leadership in your home with the example that you're setting and, you know, providing a pathway for your kids to follow, then they're going to be lost.
Yes.
And I love that, you know, you shared that experience with him and, you know, you're doing it together, which is a great bonding thing. And there's so much value in that.
Yes.
That's good parenting right there.
Yeah. And also he had goals, right? So I'm teaching him how to meet his own goals.
Mm-hmm.
And his goals were to play basketball at a certain level. So that aided that goal. So he got the aspect of you train for what you want.
Right. Well, it's interesting because you talked about, you know, learning how to run was the result of punishment, mm-hmm. right? And so many people look at running as the punitive.
Right.
And, you know, for me, running has always been a catharsis. I just love running.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people are like, oh, running's horrible. I don't know how you like it so much. And I'm like, God, I don't know how you don't like it.
Right.
And so I've always found that an interesting dichotomy because it just doesn't resonate with me. I'm like, running is great.
Right. And it didn't with me. I mean, she gave me discipline, but I enjoyed it. So.
Right. You're like, well, yeah. Fine, I'll do it. That's great. So it is interesting. And it's, I was going to ask you, you know, being a Leo, being a law enforcement officer, how, you know, parenting has got to be, I don't know, I think for all of us in public safety, you know, you come home stressed.
Yep.
And how do you parent? And I think, you know, I know how you did it, but, but, you know, how did you do that? How did you, You know, working in South Phoenix is rough. So how do you come home and shed some of that stress and turn your attention to your family and do that successfully?
Yeah. So it's easy when they're young, right? They're super cute.
And they grew out of that, man.
Look at you. You're so cute. And then the reality sets in and they have moods too, right?
Yeah.
And so you want to come home and just play with your cute baby and your cute baby's having a tantrum, right? Mm. And even that can look cute at one point. And then you realize this will not be cute to anyone else. So I got to do something about it. And then you're like, and you're making, now you're ruining my good time with you by making me discipline you. So it can get a little stressful for sure. But I think, the sooner you get your kids on the same page with you, the better. So with me and my husband as well, with our kids, we told them, here, this is what we're going to do, and this is why we're doing it. I've had a bad week at work. I need to do something enjoyable. I need to find happiness again. We're going hiking. We're going camping. We're going biking. You know, we'll go to this. We're going to the pool. And if it didn't exactly mesh with what they wanted to do, okay, so I need a swim, buddy. The basketball court's right there. You can shoot hoops while I do the workout of my swim, and then we can swim together right afterwards. And he's happy, I'm happy. And he learns that my stress relief is physical, right? Mm-hmm. And we can get into this in a bit. I've learned through life, you got to have at least 5 different things that cause you to release stress. And for me, they've always been physical because I'm athletic at heart, but right. There's a drum set sitting in here for a reason.
Yeah,
I got injured in the line of duty once, and I couldn't do my normal stress relief because it was physical and I had a broken leg. So I had to find something else or become bitchy. And that wasn't acceptable for my family. So then the drums came into my life because I was unbalanced, really. Right. So that's why I say you got to have those 5 things that if one or more of them don't work for your stress relief, those things that give you joy, then at least you have something else that you can do. And so physical is great because it gives you a physical release of any pent up energy or anger, right? But if you can't do that, where does that anger go?
Right. We take it out on our family.
We take it out on our family. Right. Yeah. And so it was about the time that I tore ligaments in my leg. That takes longer to heal than an actual broken bone.
Yeah.
So for 5 months, I was on crutches. And that was pre-surgery and post-surgery that I was on crutches. And I had to find something to do besides be snotty to my family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And interestingly, one of the common threads among endurance athletes is that they obsess about training, right? Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
Yeah.
And so when you take that away, you know, whole hog, it really creates a massive void. You know, you're training 20 to 30 hours a week on the long end, right? What do you do with that time?
Right. Yeah. You don't know. You don't know what to do with your downtime anymore.
Yeah. And if you're not, I mean, having a drum set or if you're a musician, like I play a little bit of guitar.
Right.
And so, and I mean a real little bit, but that is something you can do. I can sit down, put it in my lap and play.
Yeah.
And, you know, through some of my injuries, that's been one of the things I do just to do something else or read a book or find some way to entertain yourself that isn't, taking your negative energy out on your family. It's important. Right. And I think it's a deliberate decision you have to make because when younger in my life, I would get irritated and frustrated and with whatever was going on in my life and not be able to make thoughtful decisions toward my family. Mm-hmm. And as I matured, I realized, no, I have to consciously engage in what they're doing and consciously set aside my frustration and put that away, right?
Absolutely.
And make a deliberate decision to do that. And when I did that and realized that was the right thing to do, my relationships got better. Uh-huh. And I'm not saying I'm perfect. I still make mistakes, and there's still times when I'm very thinking about myself.
Right.
And every time I do that, it doesn't go well. Because I come home and I'm focused on what I want to do. I'm not conscientious of the other people who I live with, right?
Right.
My family, my children, my wife. And when I do that, it causes problems.
Right.
And it doesn't matter how bad my shift was, right? I don't want to bring that drama home to my family.
Right.
But I do sort of inadvertently. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to tell you about the blood and the guts and the calls. But instead, I'm just going to be a jerk to you.
Right.
Right. And that's almost worse.
So we kind of got to tell them. You don't want to tell them how ugly things are, but you got to give them a little insight. Otherwise, they're not understanding why you're grumpy.
Right. Yeah. Well, or you have to say, I'm consciously taking that information. I'm going to decompress at work, or I'm going to decompress with somebody, with your spouse. Like, I can talk to my wife and tell her what's really on my mind. But I have to make a decision and say, hey, this is what's really bothering me. I can't fold laundry right now because I'm super irritated, or whatever it is, but being honest and open and whatever is really important to decompressing that way, right? So not only having an outlet, but also having good communication skills, which kind of takes us right back to the beginning, right?
Right.
Being able to communicate effectively and willingly doing that is really important.
Absolutely.
Oh, man. All right, you go home and talk to my wife. You're in South Phoenix,
right?
And I happen to know that that one of your next assignments was pretty interesting,
right?
So tell me about that.
Okay, so you know that I worked undercover, because I think I was when I first met you. I worked undercover as a vice detective, which is your basic sex crimes and liquor crimes. Then I worked in narcotics, which is separate from Vice. They used to kind of blend together, but they separated the two units because they got busy enough.
Yeah.
So then I worked undercover narcotics.
Okay, hold on. You can't just like skip over that. You talked about the, what I seem to remember was you like setting up sting operations and you know, showing a little thigh, that kind of thing.
I was just going to skip over that.
No, we can't skip over that. That's the most important part of the story. So
yeah, we
that's
did
a,
that.
That's a really, I look at that and I go, oh my gosh, if my daughter ever, how scary is that? Now I'm putting something on it that doesn't exist, but I feel like, you know, setting up that kind of operation, you're out there on the street corner,
right?
Literally, yeah. You know,
pretending to
sell it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then what? What happens?
Super funny, though, that you say that, because I forgot to put it in the father's perspective. My dad never wanted to hear about that aspect of my job. Mm. Not at all. He was very glad when I was gone from that. But, prostitution. Back in the day, we did not look at it like we do now. I did, because I was working in that realm, but... I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that most women don't get in that business wanting to do it since they were 10.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
They've been enticed into that business. They don't know it oftentimes, but against their will. Hmm. Most of them have been victimized sexually at young ages and or because of life situations and choices that they've made. Some have gotten addicted to drugs, and that is a way to acquire more for their addiction, for their illness, not because they chose to live this lifestyle. So, you know, if somebody says, yeah, they're just prostitutes, no, they're actually not just prostitutes, they're probably victims. Mm-hmm. This has become their survival method at this point. We know that a lot of girls start as young as 14. They get enticed to it anywhere from 12 to 14. They start doing that. They're children. And so,
yeah.
And then they become, brainwashed to believe that that's all they're worth. And so that's what they do. So we attack the demand as well. So prostitution is the supply, if you will. And then the demand is the person buying the prostitute services.
Right.
So we would attack the demand aspect by having an undercover officer stand on the street acting as if she were, I don't want to say it, and part of the reason we were out there was not even just because of the prostitute, but because normal women working in the area were being accosted also. maybe they're walking to the they're a teacher walking to the school to teach class, right. And somebody comes by and mistakes them for a prostitute and says, "Hey, how much?"
Right.
For, you know, and then they'll use their terms. And you and I know, and so does an audience that we're talking about, you know,
right.
Sexual terms. Yeah. And so that became dangerous for the women working in the area. It's dangerous for prostitutes, whether they recognize the danger or not. It's very dangerous. Some of our prostitutes have become victims of massive abuse and trauma to their bodies. And then some, we've even had serial killers and serial rapists that start on the prostitute. And then other women as well. But does a prostitute deserve that when she's been enticed into this business from 12 to 14 and now believes she's not worth anything?
Right.
So we attack the demand. The female officer stands on the street gets...
solicited. Approached?
Approached. Definitely approached. And usually, you know, a deal is made for a sex act for a certain amount of money. The deal doesn't get carried out.
Of course.
I've never carried out a deal.
Okay.
But I give a signal once that deal gets made, and then my arrest team would come in and make the arrest of that person. And then now we're attacking both aspects of that.
Right.
So that was the sting operation that we used to do.
Was there ever a point where you felt unsafe or incredibly vulnerable?
Yeah. When you're the only one out on the street and your backup's like out of view, that can feel vulnerable.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I hate to admit fear, but the truth of the matter is fear is healthy. Panic is deadly. So good, healthy fear keeps you safe. So I won't say that I was not afraid ever, but I will say that good, healthy fear keeps you safe. And so you watch for signs and you keep a certain distance between yourself and someone else that you know you can react within.
Yeah.
You train yourself, you know, to do certain maneuvers, fighting maneuvers. I train myself. Even back as a rookie, I took additional training to what I got in the academy. Good. Fighting training. Not one specific. The instructors I went to combined a lot of different disciplines.
Okay.
Aikido, jiu-jitsu, some karate. So they would combine them, but they were combined specifically for law enforcement officers to utilize tactics to win a fight at all costs.
Right.
Right. So because I got the extra training, that's where fear leads to good decisions later.
Right.
Right. If I were to panic, then I shut down.
Yeah.
But fear leading to good decisions, great thing.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, fear is really important. You have to respect the consequences of what you're dealing with. Respect the enemy, if you will.
Yes.
They get a vote.
Yes.
Right? They get a choice in the matter. And in the terms of firefighting, right? The fire is a dynamic environment, right? And I would say it gives a choice because it kind of, you know, anthropomorphizes it, but it is acting on the building and the structure is decomposing and the fire is growing. And so you have to be respectful of what it can do to you.
Yes.
And the limitations of your equipment and the limitations of your resources, et cetera, right? So it's the same kind of situation is you have to size up the variables that are present and respect that those variables can kill you.
Right.
So answer this for me. When you think about, you know, when you're sizing up a situation, when you're walking into, you're approaching, not necessarily a bad guy, but you're approaching a situation, a scene. What are some of the things that you're thinking about as you're sizing it up? What are you concerned about? What are you thinking of?
And it depends on what kind of scene you're responding on, right? Just like...
I'm sorry. It makes me laugh because every time someone asks me about anything, I'm like, well, it depends.
I know, huh?
Because there's a lot of variables, yeah.
Yeah, but let's go to a worst case scenario or an average call. What do we want to do?
Well, just... Let's say you get called for like an unknown situation or a domestic or something like that, where there's kind of an unknown and you're approaching this scene knowing that something's happening, but you don't know exactly what it is.
Right. Okay. I'm going to tell you this one. That's the worst call we could ever get.
Oh.
Unknown trouble, right?
Yeah.
911 hang up. Right. Worst call we could get. It might be,
could be
a kid playing with a phone. It might be, somebody is, having a burglary and they get disconnected. It might be somebody's involved in a home invasion and they realize I got to hang up because I can't talk because I'm hiding under the bed.
Right.
Or it might be a wife and a husband who are fighting and one of them is threatening the other. If you call the police, you're going to get hurt. And so that other one hangs up. And I say, I don't differentiate man or woman because I've seen victims on both sides.
For sure.
So that whole unknown trouble could be any of those. And so when we go to a call like that, you know, you have certain training that we've always had. You're attentive to all the details coming in from your dispatcher as you're arriving. You're picturing the neighborhood as you're arriving. You're picturing what side of the street it's on. You park down the road from the actual call so that you can walk up quietly. You do walk up quietly. You do make the choice, yes or no, do I wait for my backup? And that's usually based on, I mean, standard operation procedure, always wait for your backup. But all of us know what we can and can't live with.
Yeah, let's say, is there wiggle room in that?
There's some wiggle room, yeah. And it's called personal discretion. What can I live with?
Right.
If I can see down there a man beating the shit out of a woman, am I going to wait for my backup or am I going to go take care of that?
Right.
Or if I can see a child being kidnapped, or if I can see, I mean, who knows? Maybe it's an active shooter and I can see him putting rounds into a house. And I say to myself, well, I'll give the best description I can for my backup to come in safely. And then I'm going to try and maneuver myself into a position where I could actually take a shot at that active shooter. So that's the wiggle room. And these are the life and death decisions that you make in 2 seconds that are going to be Monday morning quarterbacked to no end, which isn't a bad thing either. And I know you know that too. None of us in this business high five each other after it's over and say, good job, let's go back to work. We usually high five each other and say, thank God you're safe. And then the next day we say, what could have gone wrong if we did this instead of that?
Right.
And so a big part of everything we do is respond and then Monday morning quarterback. But at the point where you're responding, you're making a lot of decisions that are life and death, absolutely, in a matter of 2 seconds or less. And you go in and it's all based on how you've trained prior to that moment.
Right.
And how you've mentally prepared yourself.
Yeah. You brought up a really good point, which is training. And for me, that's one of the critical pivot points in our business, in public safety, is we are preparing every day for this potential event that could take place. And the variables that could happen in are so diverse. There's a great expression which people have beat to death, but I love it, which is, one does not rise to the occasion; you sink to your level of training.
Yes,
or you drop your level of training, however you want to say it. But the concept's the same. That to me is so important, right? So to me, with physical fitness, that's a big part of it. But it's with job knowledge; it's super critical that you get out there and you rep it out. You train, because those variables can adjust slightly, and you have to be willing to, you have to be ready to accommodate those changes, and you have to be proficient with your skills so that you're able to make changes.
Yep.
Otherwise, if you're not proficient, you're gonna fall. You're gonna shoot yourself in the foot. Mm-hmm. Literally.
Literally, yeah, it could happen.
Because you're panicked, and the calmness that I think one tackles these big events with, or scary events, or transitional events, is predicated upon your capacity, which is built out of training.
You get built out of training and a little bit of experience, and then rehashing that experience and more training. Yeah, yeah. It's a big circle. You're never done.
Yeah. So when you think about, so to me, like you talked about a lot about the kind of the approach to the scene and sizing that up and those variables. When you are face to face with a human being, is there what are some of the things that you're looking at when you're looking at body language and tone of voice, and like how do those play into your size?
Oh yeah, so there are some cues that a person will give off that you can tell what their mindset is, and if I think someone's going to flee, it's usually because I've watched their eyes look for that fleeing zone. If I think someone's going to fight, it's because I'm watching And I have a literal image of an incident in my head, but I'm watching this guy's abs flex repeatedly. Mm. Well, most of your movement comes from your abs, right? And they direct what comes next.
Right from your core.
Yeah. Right from your core. Yeah. So I'm seeing his abs continually flex, and I'm seeing his arms tense up and his hands ball up. So I know he wants to fight, and he is not looking for an escape at all. He's looking at me. Mm. And so I know where his mindset is. I'm going to fight, right? I'm not going down easy. I'm going to fight. Turns out he did. So I'm amping myself up.
He did fight, or he did go down easy?
He went down easy. I was in shock and almost let down, right? Because I'm like, I've geared myself up to the point where, all right, this is a fight.
Yeah.
I'm going to fight you. And I said to him, I said, it's, he broke a chair over his dad's head as I arrived on the scene. And I'm like, this guy has to be arrested. There's no question. I just witnessed this. That's an ag assault, right?
Right.
No question. Dad's an old man too. That's what made it worse. And this guy just got out of prison and he was celebrating with a little cocaine and a little beer.
Of course. Right. Of course he was.
Let's have a party. Yeah. I'm out of prison. And so, and he got out of control, made some bad decisions, broke a chair over his dad's head. Now he has to get arrested. And I'm telling him, you have two choices here. I can see you want to fight. I'm ready, willing, and able to fight you. Matt got my baton ready. I am ready. Let's play. Right? And meanwhile, I am watching his muscles flexing, and he's in good shape because he's been in prison working out.
Yeah.
And those muscles are, I can see the six pack.
What else has he got to do?
He's got a six pack, and I see them all. They're flexing. And the forearms are flexing, and you see the shoulders and the biceps, and they're getting ready. So this is how visual it is to me. And this is literally in my past about 25 years, but I can still see it. Why? Because I felt fear that night.
Yeah.
You see, yeah. I was in fear, but fear is healthy, right? We've discussed that. So I'm telling him, you have two choices. Communication skills again. We're back at it. You can turn around, put your hands on your head and get on your knees because you're going to get arrested, or we can fight. And I'm good with that. You make the choice. And lo and behold, he turned around and put his hands behind his back. After all of that, I never saw it coming because what I saw was a fight coming.
Right.
But I guess logic came to him and the baton and a look in an eye. You know, all of us get a look in our eye when we mean business.
Right.
My son used to tell me that. He was afraid of me on occasion. He's, oh, mom means business. Time to get to bed. Yeah, he saw that look in the eye and decided, I guess she means business, turn around.
Right.
And I was in shock that he actually did it. I really thought I was going to fight that night against somebody who I was not fighting in my weight class, obviously. So,
right.
Regardless, that was my job and it was going to get done one way or another. And, you know, my backup was, he was running him on the computer to see, you know, who this guy was and what we had to work with here.
Right.
And that's how I know the extra about him. But he, when he realized this, he stepped out too. And so the two of us then took him into custody. But I think that in answering your question, we see things that people do and we know what their level of cooperation is going to be. Because I've talked to just as many people that are jolly happy drunks. And you feel guilty arresting them.
Right.
Because they're so happy.
So do you think that, I mean, clearly at the end of your career, you know way more about this than you do in the beginning of your career.
Oh,
so
yeah.
How prepared are you, you know, at 22 to manage that?
Not very. It's you go through an academy for 4 months and you get this training.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all learn differently.
Yeah.
Some people learn by seeing, some by hearing, some by doing, and some by a combination of all.
Yeah.
I need a combination of all to learn appropriately for me. And so for me, seeing and hearing is not quite the same as doing. So I knew what to look for, but then communication skills graduate. They get better as you get older.
Yeah, makes sense.
There's no doubt about it.
You
look, listen, and learn, and you see what's effective and what isn't, and then you grow with that. And so at 22, you don't have those experiences yet, usually. And you get them and then things start to happen better. And it's all about reps, right? If it happens a lot, you get better at it quicker.
Right.
If it doesn't happen as often, it may take you 3 years instead of one.
Right. So. Yeah, which is interesting because you look at, you know, in all both of our businesses, depending on where you work, mm-hmm. you're going to get sets and reps mm-hmm. in all the different domains that we work in, right? Like yep. all those different evolutions that we have as part of our job package. And so it really, the experience you get really is graduated depending on where you are. It's yeah. interesting.
I know that because I saw your firefighters in South Phoenix a lot.
Yeah.
It's like most of our calls. Yeah. So I know that they were getting their reps and I know that I was waking them up a lot.
Yeah. I had the pleasure of working at one of our Southern stations for a bunch of years and that was a lot of sleepless nights.
Yeah. Yeah.
Working,
you guys didn't get any
down
sleep.
There. It's not good, man. Nope. It was brutal.
Like, I'm like, brutal. We just saw you an hour ago. Sorry to wake you up again.
Right.
But that's the business down there, I guess. And
yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, you went undercover for a while. How long did you do that?
Okay. I'd say a grand total of 7 to 10 years.
Oh, it's a big part of your career.
A chunk of my career.
Yeah.
You want to know when I got out of it?
Yeah, what was the tipping point?
My son was 2 years old, and I lied in front of him. And I was lying to a suspect because I was on a deep undercover assignment where I actually infiltrated groups of robbers, burglars, thieves, and actually had to talk to them on my downtime on a telephone here and there. Mm. And so I was talking to one of them, and obviously I'm not using my real name and I'm not using my real life experience, you know, have a backstory that is not my true backstory. And at the same time, I'm trying to teach my son not to lie. I'm lying on the phone. And then he says, "Mom, you are lying," while I'm talking to a suspect on the phone.
Yeah. Oops.
He's yelling at me. And they said, yeah, blowing my cover, son. But I didn't say that. I said that I tried to talk louder over him so that the suspect couldn't hear him. And the suspect asked me, "Who's that in the background?" I go, "Oh, that's my sister's kid." Well, now I'm not only lying, but I'm denying. I feel almost as bad as Peter must have felt in the garden when he denied knowing Jesus, right?
Right.
I felt that bad. And I said to myself when I got off that phone, after I tried to explain to my son what undercover work is at 2 years old, he doesn't right. understand that.
Right, of course not. Yeah.
And I'm like, I got to get out of this business while I'm raising a son. It's not going hand in hand. So yeah. I went to a different job within my same unit, but it was plain clothes as opposed to undercover. So I was never lying in front of my son. And I kept it that way until he was old enough to, I could explain that to him. And I ended up getting promoted and not going undercover again, only right. supervising undercovers, but not necessarily being undercover.
Right.
And so, I never had to lie to him again. And well, that was bad.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was even funny that, he, at 3 years old, he had never seen me in uniform.
And oh, right. So, he didn't have a clue what you did.
Yeah, really. He had no idea what I did for a living. He just right. knew Mom went to work. He didn't understand what. And it was Halloween. And, of course, I still have a uniform. His preschool teacher says, "Michelle, could you come to career day for us?" And I said, "Sure." So I come to career day in my uniform. And my son runs up to me and goes, "Mom, what are you trying to be?" So because he had never seen me in uniform. So he thinks I'm playing Halloween dress up.
Right.
And again, I'm thinking,
that's pretty funny.
I got to have another job that's within my department, obviously.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It reminds me of the idea that I have a whole life that happened before I had kids, right? Because my kids were born when I was in the academy. My first one was.
Oh.
And so my kiddos have never known anything but dad as a firefighter.
Right.
And I'm like, I was a Marine and I worked in a bank and I worked construction. I'm like, I did all of these things before you guys were even a thought.
they didn't know.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny because they don't know dad the Marine. Uh-uh. You know, and to them, that's this like foreign concept. And they see pictures and they're like, who's that?
Right.
I'm like, yeah, that was your dad when he was, you know, getting it on the Marine Corps, you know. Anyway, so it's just interesting how our lives are compartmentalized like that sometimes. And, you know, and it's, I'm glad that you were able to be cognizant of that, because some people are like so myopically focused that they completely lose that stuff, right?
Right.
And they trash their lives because they are so focused on one thing, you know, to their demise, right?
Yeah.
So that's a really cool story. I love the fact that he thought you were dressed up for Halloween.
What are you trying to be?
Yeah, what are you trying to be? Yeah, please. I know what a cop is. You're not a cop. That's ridiculous.
Yes, it was hilarious.
Yeah. So, okay, so you mentioned getting promoted, right? So
right.
You became a sergeant.
I did.
And what did you do as a sergeant? Where did you end up working?
So, again, all goes back to patrol. That's the root of our business, right?
Yeah.
So, when you get promoted, you go back to patrol. And I went back to patrol in Maryvale. And I worked there for about 4 years or so with my squad of anywhere from 8 to 12. In good times, we had 12.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as we dwindled to 8, and I guess they dwindled even more as the hiring freeze took over and we didn't rehire.
Yeah.
But
back in 08.
Yeah, yeah. So I worked in Maryvale Patrol happily, enjoyed a whole new career, really, you know.
So for anybody who doesn't, describe Maryvale to somebody who, the uninitiated.
Okay, Maryvale. It's a very congested, close proximity area of the city. Every house is close to the other house. A little bit dilapidated. People stopped caring for their houses, stopped taking care of them. A criminal element moved in. And then at the same time, you have a lot of kids growing up in that neighborhood with not a lot of value or benefit to their lives. And so they make their own value and benefit in the form of gangs and drug use and sale of drugs. And so you got a lot of people going down the wrong path, making bad life decisions. And it's just routinely the hot spot. We call it a hot spot in police business, but it's where all the calls for service are located.
Right.
And some of the most violent as well.
Right.
And yeah, and your fire department's responding to those same ones as well. I know they're just as busy as we were.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
What's one of our busier communities?
Yeah,
one of our busier portions of the city. And interestingly, it's the arc of that community. You know, in the 60s and 70s, that's when Maryvale kind of blew up as a kind of a bedroom community on the edge of town.
Right.
And then town, you know, the city evolved and spread
and filled in
and that became, you know, lots of single family homes,
right.
But then the apartments popped up, and then you have a lot of Section 8, and then a lot of, you know, fiscal depression throughout that whole community, and all the people with money, all the middle class families and upper middle class families moved further away,
right,
and leaving, you know, the lower economic status in that community, which really depressed it,
right.
Which to me is, you know, without knowing a whole lot about, you know, economics necessarily, but that drives some of that criminal element.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you got people that have lived there a long time from when it was brand new and built, and they built their life around that and retired there. And then you got people that have moved in because it's kind of like a broken windows theory. When you don't fix a broken window, it looks like somebody doesn't care about it. So other people who don't care about taking care of things move in, and then everything becomes blightful.
Right.
And when it does, then it leaves way for a criminal element to come in and people that are violent against each other. So in your business, you're responding to all the violence people commit upon each other to fix that up.
Right.
To clean it up, to take it to the hospital. To treat people, and meanwhile the police are responding to the crimes that have happened that caused the injuries to people.
Yeah, the first time I went on like a drive-by shooting.
There you go.
When I was working in Maryvale, the first time I went on a multiple gang-involved shooting where multiple parties had shot at each other, and was all working in Maryvale.
Right, and it graduated to home invasions. and multiple shootings within the same house, and some are just kids, and you know, kidnappings where people were being beaten and tortured within a house in Maryville. And so the crimes just graduated, got worse and worse.
Right.
And then, of course, meanwhile, our departments were dwindling in size, which means that we have even less to focus on the broken window.
Right.
So then it looks like there's more opportunity for criminals.
So from my perspective, as you lose those officers, you get more hot calls. You have no way to do like community policing. You're focused just on hot calls, really.
Right.
And you're just band-aiding the whole entire system.
Right.
Versus being able to ever get ahead of any of that stuff.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. So you're a brand new sergeant in this situation, in this neck of the woods.
Right.
What are some of the things that you're dealing with that are causing you and your officers real difficulty, or what are some of the leadership issues that you have to deal with as a new, you know, organizational leader?
Right. There's a lot of stress that goes with those type of calls. I mean, our number one big calls were home invasions and kidnappings and shootings. Those were our number one big calls in there. My officers are responding to very high stress type of calls, not just once a month, once a shift sometimes, and definitely more than once a week they're responding to these calls. And you have to be on high alert, and staying on high alert is very stressful and tiring. And it can turn you grumpy. And I got young officers that are navigating. Remember, I talked to you about this a little bit, where stress makes you grumpy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're navigating how to learn how to deal with that stress, because they're young and they're new on the job. So they're learning how to deal with the stress. And sometimes, you know, their communication with each other isn't as good as it could be, and they get mad at each other, and sometimes they turn each other into their own enemy. Mm. That was one of the bigger problems I found with my squad when I first got it, is I had two separate squads, and one squad hated the other squad. I have one squad of 10, but let's say that five of them hate the other five.
Wait, do you mean you had one squad that was kind of divided?
It was divided. That's the word I'm looking for.
Okay, I'm
yes,
with you.
My family was divided. and so I had to find a way to make my two informal leaders on either side of this division like each other.
Hmm.
And then once I could do that, I can make the rest of the squad work together, because they didn't feel that they had to show an allegiance to one or the other to be on the same team.
Right.
And that was my biggest challenge as a new leader there, is just getting that group of people to work and care about each other.
Right.
And that's, like, to me, what I learned fairly quickly is people do not care about how much you know until they know how much you care. So I have to show them somehow that I care. I care that you like you, and I want you all to work together, because I care about all of you. And I care about all of you working together, because you will not effectively be good backup for each other until you care about each other.
Right. So now I have a question for you, but I see on your desk the book Extreme Ownership. Have you finished it yet?
No, haven't finished it yet.
Okay.
I just got it.
Oh, you're so behind the times.
I am. I said I got to have this book because I want to read it.
I'm excited for you, because it's a really, really good book. And one of the principles in there, which the title speaks right to, is extreme ownership, right? That encapsulates the whole concept in there. Well, it's interesting. You talked about coming in and having this squad that's divided, and having to figure out how to navigate that and get these people to work together to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is who's responsible for that?
It's extreme ownership, girl in charge, or the guy in charge.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm glad you said that, because you get the book already. You don't have to read it.
I've read the highlights.
Right. So that's a really interesting situation when you have a team that is supposed to be fulfilling the same mission, and yet the parties inside the team have lost that connectivity with one another for whatever reason, you know,
right,
whatever's caused them to be a battle against one another. And sometimes what's interesting is that it really you know, the leader can come in and go, well, these guys are morons and they're not working together. And well, that's not my problem. It's not my fault.
Yeah. But it's, I can't make them like each other.
Right. But we have to set aside fault and right. identify the fact that the problem has to get better.
Right.
And in order to get it, you know, who's going to be responsible for that? Well, if I'm the sergeant of that unit, then
the buck stops there.
I've got to take ownership of the situation and do whatever it takes to repair it.
Right.
And that means I got to be thoughtful and smart and navigate these different human beings and communicate and facilitate communication among these players. And so I just love what you're saying, because it's really it really really is an important thing that organizational leaders need to identify and understand, that whether or not you caused the separation, you adopted that when you moved in, right? You adopted
those are my people.
Yeah, you adopt the situation. So you go, well, this is the context on the ground is this. Mm-hmm. Well, what am I going to do? Just pretend it doesn't exist and just soldier on? No, that's how people get hurt.
Yep.
Right? If I'm not willing to provide backup for that guy because I don't identify with him or I don't like him.
Right.
I can't allow that to continue to persist.
No.
And, you know, interestingly, we find that happens in all kinds of industries, but, you know, in the fireside as well, you know, we see that as well, where guys are, you know, they're focused on their own situation, or somebody else is an idiot, or they're stupid, and I don't like what they're doing. And, you know, organizational leaders have to take responsibility for what's taking place and help others own their own stuff as well.
Right.
Right.
And I mean, we have to inspire those we are leading to feel some ownership over their part of that too.
Right.
I mean, we can't just, I'm taking ownership, but I'm going to inspire this guy to realize what his role is and to own that role as well.
Right.
So you have to inspire somebody to recognize, get some ownership on that.
Exactly. It's
that's why I bought the book. I buy into it already.
To reinforce your already existing ideas.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
I love it. Well, it's funny, for when I picked that book up and started reading it, I was amazed at how many of the concepts I was like, "Oh, I love this. I fully believe this." But the book helped me kind of operationalize some of it or see it from a different perspective. So you just offered a different viewpoint to look at it. And now I'm seeing it through the lens of a sergeant and dealing with a squad, and how, you know, you have individual operators that have to work together, you know, versus fire companies who already have an existing little clique, if you will, right, that they operate in.
Right.
And sometimes those can be dysfunctional, and sometimes they are tighter than the toms on those drums over there. Right.
Yeah.
And so, getting all those different players to be focused on the mission and then focused on each other so they can affect the mission, you know, is an art form, I think. An art form
in communication.
Mm-hmm. Requiring deep
leadership.
Communication and thoughtful consideration of the players.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, you said it best, you have to care.
Mm-hmm.
And care enough that you are willing to do the work to solve the problem. You can't just say, well, gosh, this needs to fix itself.
Right.
That doesn't work.
Right.
You have to deliberately engage in the repair.
Right.
And do something differently.
Well, in my mindset, if my lieutenant has to come in and tell me, you need to fix this, Michelle, I've already failed. Mm-hmm. I should have seen it myself and fixed it. And my lieutenant shouldn't have to tell me that. And I don't ever want them coming in and mediating for me.
Right.
I'll take care of this. This is my business. I'll take care of it.
Right.
It's what you hired me to do.
Right.
So let's get it done. And then you recognize that the players, I find that if you deliver the positive first and just tweak the negative, you don't even have to point out the negative. Maybe you could tweak this to build your positive attributes.
Hmm.
Right. So I know that I could either look at them as two destructive individuals and I could call them a cancer to my squad, or I could look at them and say, holy shit, these are some good leaders. They're informal leaders and they need to lead in a different direction and encourage that. I call them to their higher purpose.
Right.
I know their purpose. They're a leader. I call them to their higher purpose. Now I make them care about each other, and all the followers care too. And then what do? I teach them, I inspire new leadership. I get them to care more about their role in this organization And I've now inspired new leaders, which is the goal of leadership, right?
Yeah.
Part of it.
Yeah, one to pass of that baton down, right? Yeah. But to get them to carry the appropriate message all the way through the chain of command and through the organization.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's really smart. I like that. And it's a very, it's people-centered, right? And you're identifying the good qualities that somebody possesses,
right,
even though they might be manifesting in a negative way.
Yes.
But, you know, you have to look at the positive aspects that your members bring to the game,
right,
and focus on their strengths, and then you develop their weaknesses, right?
Right, right.
So
step it up, right? Take your game to the next level.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
I mean, we're oversimplifying it a little bit.
Well, it's simple.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's easy.
Exactly. So well said.
The execution of it is where the magic is. That's where your money is made as a leader, right? You can be a problem identifier all day long.
Right. Yeah. One of my favorite leaders said that. He says, you know what? I got all kinds of problems. Don't come to me with a problem. Come to me with a solution.
Right.
And I love that guy.
Yeah.
Chief.
I was listening to a podcast the other day, and one of the things they talked about is if you want your career to be successful, one is like they have like 10 tenets, right, for how to be successful. And one of them was bring solutions to the table.
Yeah.
Right? Because everybody can identify problems, but come with some solutions. And the people who are in charge of your career at some point,
right,
recognize problem solvers. Nobody cares about problem identifiers.
Right.
We care about people who are willing to try and solve problems, who have ideas, who have thoughts, who are trying to move things forward.
Right.
And be helpful in the organization.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that sometimes we get mired in the mud, our feet are stuck in the mud, and so we're too busy pointing at other people and blaming versus saying, well, how can I get out of this mud? What are some solutions I can offer for all of us to rise up out of this mire and move forward?
Yep.
Yeah, that's an important part of it.
It is.
Yeah.
Full agreement.
Yeah. Well, good. Thank you. Glad you agree. I was echoing your point, I think.
this is why we're friends.
Yeah, it's just self-reinforcement. It's great.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a kind of a big question. Is there anything that's kind of happened in the course of your career where you're like, this is transformative to me in my life and has changed or shaped who you are as an adult or who has shaped who you are and the things that you've done or an event that, you know, maybe took place or something like that?
I got a couple, but I'm going to give you the more meaningful one to me.
Okay.
I mean, because, you know, I have been in some mucky situations for sure. And I could tell you, it was that night my team took down six armed home invasion suspects that fired AR-15s and semi-automatic handguns at them. And my guy had shrapnel in his face, and we went out as a team and handled that and apprehended all six of them and rescued the mom, the dad, the baby inside. And then later on, I saw that one of my guys in the gunfight, he was behind a wrought iron fence and the bullet hit the fence and fragged. So he's got these frags in his face. Mm. Well, I see him at 2 a.m. and then I don't see him again because we're doing different jobs, and he got taken off scene because he was one of the shooters. I don't see him again until about noon. So I saw him in the darkness, sent him off to get decompressed to use similar terms, right? Mm-hmm. And I see him again at noon, and he's got these blood marks all over his face. And all I'm thinking is, did someone get shot right in front of you? Were you there for the splatter? And if so, you were too close. So my brain's already gone there. And I go, Ty, why have you got this blood on your face? All over your face. And he goes, I don't know, boss. I haven't looked in a mirror. I go, you're not wounded, clearly. It's noon and this started at 2, so you're not wounded. Why do you got this blood on your face? And who hasn't told you yet? Why am I the first one telling you?
Right.
So, you know, and now it's time to go home. Well, he goes home and he thinks he's got a blackhead, so he pops it and it's bullet fragments coming out of his face. That's what the blood was.
Holy mackerel.
Right. So, you know, the nightmares come. What if that went into him?
Yeah.
You know, what if it, we're talking about 2-inch slats. What if it was 2 inches to the, and it would have, I wouldn't have Ty anymore, you know?
Right.
And one of the worst things a sergeant can do is recognize that her man went down, and then she can question what she did right or what she did wrong or how she could have prevented this. So after the nightmares, you change, right? You change. You change the way you approach things. You teach your guys, do you realize how close we were to losing one of our own? Stop the nonsense. Stop the fighting. This is now where we turn on a dime and realize we're family. And you watch that man's back forevermore. Right. And he'll watch yours. And this squad of 12, 10 to 12 will do that because I don't have time for nightmares anymore, right? It could be something like that. And now I train my squad differently. Now I take them once a month down to the academy in the hothouse, and we do live fire drills or we do paintball drills until I know that they're all good at covering each other's backs.
Right.
And then we go have dinner afterwards because, you know, you bond over dinner.
Right.
You know, you bond over training. You bond over recognizing that the guy standing next to you will not quit until it's done. And you go out safely with him. You both go home that night. You bond over that. And then you bond over food. So you get these guys to bond. That changed me as a supervisor. But my happy story is this one. I'm a rookie. I definitely was still in my 22nd year of life. and I am a by the book kind of officer, right? No warnings. You get tickets. Right. No warnings. And so, because I didn't know how much discretion I could use yet either. That comes later. Well, I pull a guy over. He's driving super fast down this Roosevelt Street. And there is a bump in Roosevelt. And if you hit it at a certain speed, you'll go flying. Well, I heard him go flying. And I know what speed he's going. And I know it's well over 25 miles an hour that happens. And so I pull
him. How do you know that?
I was hoping you didn't ask, but
you might have tested it just to know.
I know by accident. I was going lights and siren to a call, and I did hit that really fast, and I did fly.
Okay.
And it was frightening.
That's what I suspected.
And it was frightening. And so I like, okay, you only have to trick me once. I will remember that's there forever. Well, I see him go by. I hear him fly. I know he's speeding. I get behind him just long enough to know he's speeding, like the clocking that you have to do for courtroom purposes. And I pull him over. And super nice guy. I mean, the attitude that we talked about earlier when you judge people, this guy's a nice guy and I know it. I can tell. He's calling me ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Super polite. Here's my license, registration, insurance, right? Okay. But I've been on long enough that I've heard a lot of lies too. So far, he isn't lying to me. I said, so where are you going so fast? And he goes, to an AA meeting, Alcohol Anonymous. And I'm like, yeah, sure you are. You're going to the bar. Right. Right. So I don't believe him. I end up writing him a ticket, right? And give him his ticket and say, slow down. And he says, okay, thank you, ma'am. Super polite still, even though I just gave him a ticket. And so go on with my night, go on with my week. The next week, and he told me he was going to Caro's for the AA meeting, the restaurant. And because they're open all night long instead of the bar, the AA meeting would meet there instead of going to the bar. And I did not believe him until the next week when I went to lunch at Caro's, and there he was with a group of people, and they were all there for an AA meeting. And I looked at him, I go, you really were going to an AA meeting? And he just nodded, right? And he didn't really want to talk to me at all. I just gave him a ticket. And I'm like, oh, I feel bad now. I feel bad. And I always felt bad about that guy and not giving him some discretion and a warning. Hmm. I wished I gave that guy a warning. So I go on with my career. Caro's is open at night. I go to lunch to Caro's all the time. I see the guy all the time. I wave at him. It's an awkward, it's an awkward hello between both of us. We both know I gave him a ticket.
Yeah.
And so I say, on with my career. I go do my undercover route. I get promoted. I go to this Caro's one night to meet some other sergeants for dinner. I go to this Caro's. Guess who's there? That guy. We're talking 10, 15 years later. And again, I know him because he's that guy that I always wished I'd given a warning to. So, and he's kind of by himself or off by himself at this point. So he goes, hey, do you remember me? And I go, oh yeah, I do. And he goes, I remember you. And I go, yeah, I'm going to tell you something right now before you go any further. I've always felt bad. I've always felt bad about giving you that ticket. And I want you to know that because of you, I gave more warnings later because I felt so bad about it. And he goes, oh, well, I felt pretty bad lately thinking about that too because I lied to you. And I'm like, what? But I see you every week at this AA meeting. He goes, yeah, but not that night. I was going to the bar. But you gave me a wake-up call when you pulled me over.
Oh, interesting.
You gave me a wake-up call. I got that ticket, and I didn't go to the bar. I went to the meeting. So you don't have to feel bad anymore. And at that point, I'm like, life has changed for me. Because why? Not because the guy lied to me and I believed him and I let myself feel guilty for years, but because I learned we are put in a certain place at a certain time for a certain reason, and we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And if we're lucky 15 years later, we get to find out what that was. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. He's been clean ever since.
You 100% changed that guy's life.
Right. Because I gave him a ticket. Because I was a bitch and I gave him a ticket. And that's what I felt like all those years. Every time I saw him, I'd go, wow, what a bitch I was giving him that ticket. But you know, a little tiny thing like that, wow, it can make a career worthwhile.
Yeah.
And you would have never known it.
Right.
Unless, you know, you just got that opportunity 15 years later to have someone come clean and tell you, oh, you changed my life that night. You gave me a ticket.
Yeah.
And I recognized that I was about to make bad decisions, and I didn't, and I've been clean ever since.
Yeah.
So,
you know, it's interesting. There's been a couple of decisions I've made in my career that I was following my gut, and where I felt like, you know, I don't, the policy says this, but my gut says this, and it was it made all the difference.
Right.
And it wasn't until later that I realized that if I had made the different decision, this would have turned out totally different.
I love that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, and I think going back to your first story that you just mentioned, there's the thing that is interesting to me is that a lot of times when people get promoted, their friends and their subordinates will be like, oh, you know, it's Sergeant 180. You know, suddenly she wants to follow the policies and suddenly she's all scared and...
Right.
And, you know, she's afraid to do anything hardcore anymore because she's a big baby. But interestingly, I think that part of the reason that happens, I'm going to make a defense for all supervisors.
And I know I'm going to agree with it. I know where you're going to go. Well,
you begin to see risk differently.
Yes.
Right? And it's not because we're afraid to do things. We're not afraid to do, you know, to go into the gauntlet, but we understand the consequences of it. And I think, and I'm going to put this on you, but you're not just worried about your officer, because if something happens to that officer, he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's horrible, but you also have to answer to his fellow officers in your squad and other officers on the department.
Yep.
And then you have to answer to his, and more importantly, to his family.
Yeah.
Right? Husband, wife, children, parents,
mom,
cousins,
dad.
Right? And then on top of that, the broader spectrum of that is, as the circle goes out, is you've got a community who is looking and saying, well, what? How did this officer get killed? Right? What took place? And who's responsible for that? And that goes all the way up to city management, and sometimes it goes national.
Right.
Right? And you have people looking back, Monday morning quarterbacking, right?
Right.
That's
what
we talked about.
Yep.
Looking back at this event saying, well, call, if that person's supervisor had done their job, this officer would still be alive.
Right.
And so... And, you know, that, of course, it's all very circumstantial, but the ownership for that when you are the supervisor in high risk situations is very real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's we begin to try to balance what we understand is appropriate risk with this sense of doing the job, but doing it well, but without overextending ourselves beyond what's appropriate. And that's a very difficult balance. And it's hard when... You know, you're the officer at the tip of the spear, and you feel like get this leash off me. You know, keep holding me back.
Right.
But you get to a point in your career where you know more. You mm-hmm. understand the complexity. You understand the risk at a different level.
Right.
And you understand the consequences of that risk. So, I see you, you know, you're shaking your head, and you know, I know that for me, that was a very transformative thing in my career when I began to, you know, take that role on as a frontline supervisor, realizing that these, you know, the men and women who are with me, I'm responsible to get them home.
Yep. Right?
We call it, in the fire service, or in, you know, in my agency, we call it a round trip ticket, right? Oh.
Yeah.
Right. So from one beginning of the tour to the end of the tour,
right? We need to go back home.
Right. In one piece. Yeah. Right. I don't want you physically scarred or emotionally scarred. Right. So I'm going to do everything in my power to like help keep you well throughout this whole spectrum of events we're going to go and deal with during the course of this, you know, shift.
Right.
And, you know, so that the, you know, where do you begin and end that obligation, you know, depends on the individual. But, you know, at the very least, while they're in your stewardship, you have ownership of that.
Yeah.
And you got to look out for your people. And I think it goes back to what we've been talking about all along, which is this sense of love. And you didn't say that word, but I'll say it.
That's all right.
This sense of love.
Because I felt it.
Yeah. I know, and I know you do. That's why I say that, because we, you know, these, the men and women that we are working with, we respect and love them, and we have to operate with that in our heart. And understand that that's the level of compassion we have to have for these people. And so we have to be thinking about them on a regular basis and considering their position and considering what their needs are and taking care of those needs.
And you are, and we are, hiring high quality people. We already know that. Our processes, yours and mine, they are meant to find high quality people. And we do.
Right.
These are high quality people. We got to get them home to their high quality families.
Right. Well, yeah, if they're going to continue to serve this mission throughout the course of their career, they got to survive.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's our responsibility as organizational leaders at that level to help them be productive and effective and successful throughout the course of their career so they can continue to fulfill the mission.
Right.
Right. Because nobody's, you know, if you get killed in the line of duty, you're not helping anybody.
Right.
And, you know, certainly not helping yourself or your family or the community that you swore to serve.
Right. Right.
So,
and you're breaking a lot of hearts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Breaking the hearts of everyone that works next to you.
Yeah. So it's
and your family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I think that's a great place to stop right there.
All right. We covered a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Michelle, thank you so much. I think it's so important that that as a firefighter, that I understand the thoughts and the consideration and things that you're pondering as a law enforcement officer. It really helps me understand better how to fulfill my job. And
and likewise, we are out there on the streets together, and we respond to a lot of the same calls. And when tragedy hits, we're definitely going to be there together. So it's definitely important for us to understand each other's positions. And I love hearing about your perspective and realizing that there's a lot of comparisons that can be made.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I want to thank Michelle for taking the opportunity to sit down with us and have this conversation. It is so important that we build a relationship between, you know, the different types of public safety agencies that are out there, and where PD and fire come together is really, really important. I've seen plenty of operations where good communications between the PD officers and fire have helped make the operations smoother and more effective. And at the end of the day, our objective is to take care of the public in the best way possible. And if we are highly professional and highly polished in the way that we interact with one another, we are going to be way more successful in doing those things. So today, you know, Michelle talked about size up and talked about health and wellness, and, you know, and talked about communication and how important that is as a leader and in your unit, the ability to communicate with your people and to be an effective leader for them. But the interagency communication is really important as well. And so once again, thanks, Michelle, and I appreciate your service and appreciate your time today. Now, go out there and get some.